It's not that easy being
deadpan.
It'll do fine. It's beautiful. And I think it's what I wanna be.
Deadpanites, give me some Tomy, baby.
Hey, welcome to Deadpan 41. I'm your host, Jack Mangan, a.k.a. the guy who doesn't always finish his. So this episode is a very special one. We have John Shirley, one of the absolute founding fathers of cyberpunk, as our special guest. We recorded so much, actually, that I wasn't really sure what to do with the content. So what I've decided to do is to split it up over two episodes. So he's actually going to have this episode and the next one, which is number 42. And what I think that's going to mean for number 42, we'd originally planned for that to be the Greasy Spoon finale, but I think we're going to have the Greasy Spoon finale in episode number 43. So you have one extra chance to win Greasy Spoon. And for those who've been following along, that's more time for me to figure out the actual standings. Incidentally, I actually screwed up at the beginning, I fixed it, but I originally said, welcome to Deadpan 31 instead of 41, I have no idea why. Well, I think I know why. We'll get into that in a second. I didn't actually detect the error on my own. I was actually handed a paper that read, that says, you started off the show with Deadpan 31, then referred to 42 plus 43, dumbass. And that's actually correct. I went back and checked. And I said 31 at the beginning, when this is Deadpan 41. And I'm going to leave it in there.
Dumbass.
And of course, Deadpan 31 was a landmark episode where, well, that was the one where I explained why I grumbled so much and the real reason behind our mantra for 2006, which of course was, fuck 2006. All right, let's start things off with an unrelated thought. This one's actually quite relevant to this episode. All of the religious fanatics who were hysterically promoting their own version of the impending end of the world or apocalypse or rapture are going to be really sorry when the singularity hits. What's that? You want something that's a little less geeky? All right. If you're at a computer, then go to Amazon.com. If you're not at a computer, then get to one. Or get to a record collection that has a decent amount of 80s metal. If you have to, then hit pause in your player and start again when you're there. All right, we want to look up the band Scorpions. Of course, you remember them. And we want to look at the album cover for Blackout. And I want someone to explain to me just what the fuck is going on there. I mean, no wonder it's a blackout. You have forks over your eyes. Right, now, what eye doctor writes this prescription? I mean, is that from Pearl Express? Is it possible that he's not actually screaming in terror or agony there, as it appears? But that really he's just singing the chorus to Macho Man?
Jeez, that light is bright.
Man, where the hell are we?
Dude, we're tied up.
Tied up? This is ridiculous.
Mr. Sigler, Mr. Hutchins, I got a message from T. Morris.
Hey, wait a second. Didn't you whack us in the last promo?
Shut up.
Ah!
The boss is working on a new podcast novel.
Oh, yeah, right. Does he even remember how to make one of those? It's been a while.
Shut up.
Oh.
This is Billabub Battings and the Case of the Singing Sword.
Billabub Battings?
And the Case of the Singing Sword?
The finalist from Forward Magazine's Best Fiction of 2004 and the Independent Publisher's Best Science Fiction of 2005.
And whodunit.com describes as Sam Spade, Mickey Splane, and Joe Friday combined with stories of Terry Brooks or J.K. Rowling?
Shut up. So if you go to tmorris.com and click on the banner for the Billabub Battings podcast, you can subscribe there. Capiche? Capiche?
You told us to shut up.
Billabub Battings in the Case of the Singing Sword. Launching St. Valentine's Day, 2007. Find out more by clicking on the Billabub Battings podcast banner at www.tmorris.com.
You know, Hutch, Earthcore was a Forward finalist in 2006 too, buddy.
Shut up.
Ouch. Mommy.
Hey, it's Alfie and Boulder. You are listening to Jack Mangan's Deadpan Podcast. Deadpan's a motherfucking way. I love you so much, Jack. It hurts how much I love you. You have no idea. What?
So, Deadpan, it is really a great honor to have on today one of the most influential authors in my career and just one of the most important authors in the cyberpunk realm. You also may know him for having written the screenplay for the Crow film and also for writing lyrics for Blue Oyster Cult in their latter days. I'm really honored to have on Deadpan this week, John Shirley. John, thank you very much for coming on.
Good to be here.
And of course, I left out of your intro your latest book, which we should definitely delve into because it's a great premise, and it's called The Other End. And you know what? I'll let you tell the folks out there all about that book and why they should be interested in it.
The Other End is a novel of the alternative apocalypse. I mean, we typically get apocalyptic scenarios thrust upon us by the religious right. And from fundamentalists of all stripes, from various religions.
Mm-hmm.
They usually a judgment day in which the majority of the people hearing about the apocalypse are to be condemned to screaming eternal punishment.
Right, as and, they should be, damn it. Sorry, go on.
The people promulgating those kinds of apocalyptic scenarios probably should, you know, be subjected to an apocalypse and judgment of their own, perhaps. I feel that it was necessary to create a judgment day for the rest of us. you could say this for people on the left, if you want, although I think it's fairly balanced. It's just a kind of common sense judgment day. And the idea is, like, suppose that you, whoever you are out there, could design your own judgment day. What would that be like? If you could be in charge of weeding out whoever you think should be weeded out through the, you know, the hand of some cosmic force that would do it all at once, and if you could be in charge of redesigning the world. Apocalypse is sort of a vision of change, and it doesn't have to be just destruction. It's really predicate, the beginning of transformation. So you suppose that you could design that transformation. And I've made up one that works for me and that I think a lot of people would relate to. It's sort of my way of rebooting the world, at least psychologically. And what I'm really trying to do is create alternative paradigms for what life could be like if people had a different approach, you know, if people emphasized consciousness over criticism.
Right.
Although I am pretty critical in this book, it's what I'm really advocating is an increase in consciousness that would be transformative for the planet. So, you know, if you think that the human world is hopelessly blighted and off track, what would allow the human race to start over? That isn't the usual apocalyptic cliches. And I come up with a completely another approach in The Other End. I don't use God per se. There is a kind of higher consciousness or other dimensional consciousness that comes from the accumulated fullness of all things everywhere, the absolute, it's called in some mystical texts, it sort of redesigns the world from the ground up in three stages. But it's not God per se. And in fact, I take a sort of Gnostic view in this book, and what was usually thought of as God is a kind of villain in this book, actually. Not that we're on the side of, you know, the traditional diabolic entity or something, not at all. It's just that the Gnostic point of view is that the world as we understand it is essentially out of balance and innately wicked, and in some sense, or at least a kind of endemically unhealthy, and it's not supposed to be this way. There was a mistake made millions of years ago. And so the book also goes into how that came about to some extent.
Okay. Now, when I met you at Worldcon, you read a little bit of this, and you delved into that a little bit. It seemed that you were very adamant about pointing out that, yes, it is more about an apocalypse for somewhat left-thinking, but more, you know, rational-thinking people. So it wasn't exactly sort of a, if you will, a right-behind as opposed to a left-behind.
Yeah, I mean, the people who, it's true that it is a kind of reaction to the left-behind books. Mm-hmm. And the people who wrote the left-behind novels are mentioned indirectly in the book as being left-behind. But where people go afterwards is not exactly heaven. It's something else which I don't want to give away. It's not another planet, but it is a kind of another place in a sense, but I don't want to give that away.
Okay.
You have to read the other end to find out. From the Cemetery Dance book coming out late this month, finally.
Okay, so the end of January 2007, then.
Well, for Cemetery Dance, that's really quite expedient. And of course, that's just the first limited edition. We're planning paperback and trade paper and so on, and we're talking to people about that now.
Okay. Now, I guess a little bit more, I found it interesting you talked a little bit about the gods. So there is actually, you do mention then a sentient being then that's sort of behind all of this.
Yes, but he's not God per se, but he's an entity, he or it is an entity that people have designated as being God or Jehovah, if you like. He's just kind of a supervisor who wasn't being supervised well enough himself. He was the planetary supervisor, and he went ballistic. He went a little nuts, he infused the world with just way too much existential horror. See, it's the idea is that you look around at the world and you think, you know, some privation is understandable, and some difficulty is understandable. It promotes evolution. I mean, conflict and struggle promotes our evolution, our physical evolution, and our psychological evolution. And if there is a spiritual evolution, that too. But in our world, sometimes you have to wonder if somebody's got their finger on the scales and they push down too hard on the dark side.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I mean, we have the Black Plague, and we've had the Holocaust, and we've had a tendency to generate serial killers. We've had all kinds of genetic horrors. A lot of people are just born with innate difficulties that may be behavioral or whatever. They have not really had the opportunity to live good lives, or fulfilling lives. That's the human condition.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm suggesting that the human condition may not actually be what it's supposed to be. And maybe the human condition was supposed to be something at least a little more balanced. And something came along and pushed it out of balance. And that's an ancient Gnostic principle. Philip Dick got into it too. If you read his final novels and his Exegesis, I'm not exactly a Philip Dickian person spiritually, but it is a kind of a page from his book, but it really started several thousand years ago the Gnosticism that started in Egypt and then emerged in Gnostic Christianity, which was just almost indistinguishable from some of the most mystical Buddhism, really.
And again, now what you're referring to is, I guess this is such a cliche, but sort of the dark side of humanity. You're talking about just our seemingly limitless capacity for just for evil and for the willingness to destroy each other and for malicious actions towards each other.
There's that, and then there's the world itself. It should be tough, but perhaps since we have this sense that we're here for a purpose and that we are supposed to be playing a kind of existential game and getting somewhere. Perhaps the game has been unfairly weighted. That you know, the rules have been tampered with, and the other team isn't playing fair.
Okay.
And so this kind of assumes that, and then somebody, the referees come, so to speak, to continue the sports metaphor, and they blow the whistle and they say no, that you know, you're supposed to have some suffering in life and some conflict, but you know, to be born in Darfur and then watch while your mother is raped and murdered, and then to wander off so that you can starve in the desert if you're lucky, probably is not supposed to be the fate of the majority of the human race. You know, I mean, of mm-hmm. that kind of thing, that kind of third world horror that hundreds of millions of people are subjected to. You know, the people in slums in Rio and so on, and vast numbers of people suffering in India, they're probably not supposed to be subjected to that level of, you know, impossible suffering. It's supposed to be a little more, you know, the world is supposed to be more open than it is. And so in this fantasy, it opens up and the balance is restored. And it kind of... But I also put a lot of emphasis on political responsibility and mm-hmm. you know, make people take responsibility who aren't. I do it artificially or, you know, through the means of my fiction in the other end.
Okay. Now, is this the sort of thing? It sounds there is a strong spiritual angle to this. Is this the sort of thing that 20 years from now celebrities are going to be citing this as their religion?
If they do, then they'll probably make some hideously devolved, confused version of it.
Right.
I mean, that's what happens. That's something in the fourth way they call the law of seven, where you have a principle that starts off and goes in a certain direction, and then it's interfered with by just the nature of things, like an arrow being, running up against an air current and gravity and not hitting its mark. So you start off something one way and it becomes depraved. Just like, the teaching of Christ became, I'm not comparing myself to him, the teaching of Christ became the Inquisition.
Right.
So I would hope not, actually. I would hope it starts a religion based on it, because if they do, they'll debase it and make it something awful. Like, you can think of numerous examples. I'm sure that Muhammad would not be pleased with some things happening in the world today.
I generally do an arc of past, present, and future now. So that is the present now is, and the near future is the other end. Now, are there going to be more books in this? Just like the Left Behind series has, you know, all those books that are making lots and lots of money. Are there going to be more in this? Or what else do you have lined up for the future?
There was originally a final chapter that I've cut from it, in which we see what life was like after the other end. But I cut it because it really took too much explanation. And it became too laden with exposition. So that will remain for a sequel if there is one. I'll find some way to dramatize those ideas. You know, I'd like to do one if the book is popular enough. One model would be, if you remember the Philip Wiley Bomber and Edwin Bomber novel, When Worlds Collide, kind of semi-forgotten, but science fiction fans will know it. And it was made into a pretty good movie for the time, When Worlds Collide. And then there was a sequel, which was very entertaining, After Worlds Collide. Somebody should remake When Worlds Collide, because it's a great story. It's about, you know, another planet comes and smashes the Earth, and then there's a moon of that planet that takes the place of the Earth, and people discover they're able to move to that moon, and they find the remnants of an old civilization there, and it sort of implies an apocalyptic restarting. That may have been kind of my model in a indirect kind of a way with the other end. I'd like to do something like that.
You are listening to Jack Mangan's podcast show. Deadpan is the way.
I gotta be crazy!
This is crazy!
Hello, Deadpan. This is Ed from Texas. Jack,
I'm calling to let you know that you are not the only one with crazy parents. Growing up as a young boy, like many of you, the cabinets in the kitchen were all equipped with those child-proof door locks. But in my house, they just never went away. All through high school, and even after I left for college, those safety locks remained on the cabinets. Even my wife clearly remembers those locks on the cabinets when we would go home to visit. In time, it got to be that I just didn't notice them anymore. Bending the little plastic tab was just a normal part of opening the cabinet. Well, I've been married for many years, and sometime in the last few, my dad finally removed those little tabs. And how did I discover this, you may ask? Why, my daughter, who was about 2 at the time, and all into exploring, walked up to those cabinets when we were visiting one time and opened them right up. I'm almost certain that my dad took those locks off around the time that my daughter was born. I think he got it in his head that his kids were now adults with kids of their own, so he didn't really need those locks anymore. And it just never occurred to him that he was closer to the time when he would have little kids around the house again exploring those cabinets. So that's my crazy parent story. And I'm sure Jack and I aren't the only ones. So let's hear about yours.
You're listening to Jack Mangan's Deadpan. God, I'm so excited.
The next book that I'm pretty sure I'm going to write, if I can pay for the time to write it by writing scripts, probably, is Gauntlands. Right now, that's the title. It's about a famine in North America. And in the near future, I mean, I'm not talking about the year 3000 or something. I'm talking about before 2040, probably. There's a series of climate-related and toxin-related catastrophes and social catastrophes that converge. You have a convergence of negative factors that cause agriculture in the United States to crumble and a sort of a dust bowl effect, but much bigger. For example, right now I'm told that a lot of people aren't aware that the Corn Belt in America is threatened by global warming because the water for it comes from a place that will be impacted by global warming. That water will essentially, to make a long story short, dry up and become unavailable, and will be have difficulty watering the America's breadbasket. That won't cause famine in America per se, but it's one of many factors that could lead to it. Another is that is political isolation could lead to it, and if you have a swing back to the right again, which I believe might be possible, or a coup in the United States, which is also possible. Then we become politically isolated and we lose access to imports. But for various reasons, people are suddenly experiencing in America what people in Africa, in some parts of Africa, routinely experience almost. There are nearly perennial famines in many parts of Africa. They're just used to it. They expect them almost. Unfortunately, it doesn't have to be that way. Of course, eventually we'll figure out how to feed everyone. But
as long as it's profitable.
Well, it can be made profitable, or you know, and people will figure out that long-term thinking is actually more intelligent in terms of profitability than short-term thinking. I think that global warming will explain that to them in a sense. What would America be like if we experienced the kind of famines they've had in Ethiopia, for example? I mean, obviously there would be social chaos. Exactly how would it come down? Would it be like Road Warrior? Well, I don't think it would be quite like that. I think it would be more like contemporary Somalia. I think we would have warlords, and we would have pockets of very protected, isolated areas where people had food, and then great areas, swaths of land where there was none, and great areas of prosperity, and not prosperity, but where people were privileged, and other areas which where people were large areas in America, where people were underfed, undernourished, and you could say, say it's like that now. Actually, we have more people in America undernourished than the average person knows. I think it's something like 1 in 6. But
wow.
In this case, it would be something like 4 in 6, at least. Maybe 5 out of 6 people in America would be undernourished or starving in my story. So what would be the social impact? How would people deal with it? What would be the effect on America in the long term? And, you know, what would it be? What would it do to our perception of the third world? And would it maybe have the long-term effect of making us think more globally?
Okay. Now, that's Gauntlands, and that's in the works.
It's
then.
I have it in the form of an outline, and I'm going to probably write the book, because to sell a book nowadays on the basis of an outline, you have to basically be Tom Clancy or someone. I mean, it's
okay.
Really difficult. Things have changed in the publishing industry, and they're more. The publishing industry is owned by bigger and ever bigger corporations. Mobil Oil, for example, you know, owns some publishers, and and so they bring the kind of corporate bean counting mentality to the purchase of books, and it is more difficult now. I mean, even people, really established figures like William Bowman, I understand, have had trouble. So I plan to write the entire book and really get it rocking, you know, and polished, and then start showing it around so people will be able to see what they get. That's what you have to do now. It's an industry where nowadays you have to elbow and push to survive, as if you were in Grand Central Station during rush hour and when there's an earthquake.
Okay. Yeah, that's, you know, as a very microscopic novelist myself, I feel like, and those are all the indications I get when I look at, you know, what I want to do with, you know, my writing career. But now again, you've definitely done really well. I mean, you've been an icon for 30 years.
Well,
so,
you know, there are different sides of it. I mean, I've done pretty well in some ways, but writers, there are a lot of writers who've done pretty well who are now finding it more difficult to connect with the marketplace. And it's more it's not really to do with the public, reading public. It's more to do with just the way the marketplace is structured, in my opinion. It's the corporate mentality. You know, on the other hand, it's never quite simple. It's also true that big publishers are always looking for new people or new projects from older people, but especially for new people. They're always looking for something. Their doors are open and locked at the same time. It's really peculiar. I mean, you have to almost know the magic words, like open sesame. You have to find a way in, but they really do need new material. I mean, it's an industry that's constantly looking for books and stories, and it grows rather than shrinks. And then there's also a kind of middle-sized publishing industry. There are alternative publishers now who are a pretty large part of publish. If you go on Barnes and Nobles, you find more of them now. And then, of course, the fact that books are sold mostly in big chains like Barnes and Noble has had a big impact. Because the big chain, if the big chain says we don't want this kind of book, that book probably won't get bought by a publisher. You have to be able to write something that Borders or someone like that will want. And that's different. It used to be. You know, that there were a lot more people that had a say, and now it's fewer people. It narrows the gate, so it's kind of sad. But the other side of it is there's always a way in, and they still need new people, and they still need new material. So I'm saying all this so that people like you and new writers don't get discouraged. It has always been necessary to never give up. if you really believe in your writing and really believe you're a writer or an artist or a musician, mm-hmm. I mean, you have to really believe it. Don't just do it because you think you ought to be. You've got to know you're a writer or artist or musician because it's hard. But if you really know it and if you really believe it, then persistence is a big factor.
Hey, this is Mike Nelson, and you're listening to Jack Mangan's Deadpan Podcast. Keep it tuned here.
My name is H.R. Tucker, and I need to warn you about a dangerous being about to be turned loose. He is called the Computer King. He is immensely powerful, and he is the living embodiment of our darkest fears and desires. The proof is at www.computerkingonline.com. Once he uses me as a portal, he'll be... free. Now I can begin the rampage anew, and I intend to take you with me. I live in the darkest recesses of the mind, and what I bring is all that darkness in tangible form. Listen to H.R. Tucker on Into the Dark, and I'll make an appearance now and then. And yes, when I do, there will be blood. Come to www.computerkingonline.com, and I'll take you into the dark.
All right, and so we've reached the end of another Deadpan episode. There's plenty more to come with John Shirley, and I'm sure I made just as much incidental noise on my end for the second half of the interview as I did for the first. What the hell was that? Anyway, it's really great stuff. You're going to want to hear the second part, too. He's really a fantastic guest. All right, so the comments are well over 1,000 again this week. I'm proud of you guys. We pulled together and we made it. So we're going to do some Greasy Spoon comments and just a quick explanation. We draw out random comments from each episode's comment section, pick a couple at random and read them on the podcast, and then when this whole little contest is over, whoever's had the most randomly chosen and read on pod wins a free meal with me. And, you know, there are more. There's fine print and all, but you know enough. So let's read the four for this week. And there's a decidedly racy tone to the comments this week. Anyway, so the first one, Alvi, says, spherical what now? Second one, Alvi, again. Alvi's cleaning up. He says, I saw that ditto, lots of exclamation points. What do you think about that? Lots of question marks. Oh, I was totally behind the scenes banging Josie and the Pussycats. Dot, dot. And by that, I mean masturbation. Ellipsis. Sorry, Andrea. Yes, I should have said that. Ellipsis or ellipsis. Come to the boardroom. Okay. So the next one is from Jessica. Star strips off her clothes and runs around naked. Star. I'm alone and naked in the deadpan bar. Star, giggle. Puts clothes back on before anyone comes back. Star. And the final one, ditto. The comparison was not accidental, I assure you. What I want to know is when did the Borg assimilate the Energizer Bunny, and how does that affect Hugh now? Winking smiley face. Alright, so that affects the standings. I'm not sure how, and you know what, it's late, so I'm not going to look them up. Sorry. I think Alvi's still in the lead, though Ditto is trying to get back. That's it for Deadpan. Your contributions are always welcome. Send in your dumbass memories, the contents of your fridge, your crazy parent stories, stolen rap lines, stolen 80s lines, whatever, you know, whatever floats your boat, just call and say hi. The voicemail line is 206-350-TOMI. It's 206-350-8664. Or send an email to jack@jackmangan.com. And all right, as always with Deadpan, we're going to end with some original music of mine. And actually, you know, I have to let you know that here we are at episode number 41, and I'm almost out of original material to play here. I think, you know, we've done fairly well going this far, and we're not out completely. But for this week, I'm going to play a repeat of a mash that I edited up. So this one doesn't actually have me playing any live instruments. We'll do one of those in the next episode. So back by popular demand to close out episode 41, One with the Stillness. I'm not coming back after the music. I'm not going to do the back after the music joke. I'm editing pretty late, and yeah, I'm done. Thanks for tuning in. Catch you next week, or next episode. Well, you know, I should add some more babble to the outro babble. There's plenty more music, just a matter of getting it recorded. All right. Deadpan is the way. Or, as Jessica said in an honorary Greasy Spoon comment, deadpan for life.